Members of Deakin University Council, Dr Barry Jones AO, a good friend of Deakin, Professor George Pappas, Chancellor of Victoria University, and Mrs Jill Pappas, members of Deakin University's Melbourne Leaders Group, distinguished and honourable guests, senior staff and students of Deakin University, industry colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Matthew Clark and I'm head of Deakin University's School of Humanities and Social Sciences, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you here tonight for this very special public lecture by Professor Noam Chomsky. I wish to begin by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, the traditional custodians of the land upon which we are gathered today. We pay our respects to them for their care of the land. A primary purpose of Deakin University and my School of Humanities and Social Sciences is to serve the communities in which we work and to be a catalyst for positive change. There are more than 5,000 people here tonight and many more thousand online, all here to listen to Professor Noam Chomsky. As many of you will be aware, the publicity for this event was generated solely through social media, Facebook and Twitter. As you'll also be aware, tickets for this event were fully allocated in a single day, again publicised solely through social media. There is no doubt that the world in which we live is rapidly changing. Deakin University and my School of Humanities and Social Sciences rightly seek to be part of this change. Hosting Professor Noam Chomsky for his only Melbourne public lecture is therefore a great honour and privilege. I'd like to remind you that following Professor Chomsky's lecture, there will be a question and answer session. Questions can be posted during his lecture via the Twitter address up on screen. We've also received many questions prior to tonight's lecture. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Vice-Chancellor of Deakin University, Professor Jane Den Hollander, whom will formally introduce our distinguished guest.
I too begin by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people and I pay my respects to their elders past and present. And that's particularly true on a night such as this, when education, a university is involved in a large community engagement about what we think and some of the issues around what we do. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I add my words to those of Professor Clark and welcome you to this very special Deakin University event. One of the roles of a university is to advance public knowledge in the communities we serve. It is part of our commitment to the creation, the advancement, the transmission, and the application of knowledge and skills. Those of you who have joined us for this special free public lecture this evening will find that we are living up to that commitment. It is therefore my very great pleasure to introduce Professor Noam Chomsky, who will present a lecture this evening entitled Changing Contours of Global Order. Professor Chomsky was born in 1928 in Philadelphia in the United States of America. He is reported to have written his first article at the age of 10 about the rise of fascism in Europe. He received his PhD in linguistics in 1955 from the University of Pennsylvania. The major theoretical viewpoints of his doctoral dissertation appeared in the monograph Syntactic Structure in 1957. This formed part of a more extensive work, The Logical Structure of Linguistic Theory, circulated in mimeograph in 1955 and published in 1975. Professor Chomsky joined the staff of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in 1955 and in 1961 was appointed a full professor. In 1976, he was appointed institute professor in the Department of Linguistics and Philosophy. In 1998, Professor Chomsky received the Toyota Prize for Basic Science, given, and I quote, to honor those who have contributed significantly to the scientific, cultural, and spiritual development of mankind. The prize noted that, and I quote again, Dr. Chomsky's theoretical system remains an outstanding monument to 20th century science and thought. He can certainly be said to be one of the great academicians and scientists of this century, unquote. He has lectured at many universities across the world and is the recipient of many honorary degrees and awards. He has written and lectured widely on linguistics, philosophy, intellectual history, contemporary issues, international affairs, and the US foreign policy. Among his recent books are New Horizons in the Study of Language and Mind, On Nature and Language, Hopes and Prospects, and Gaza in Crisis. His most recent publication was 9/11, Was There an Alternative? It was published in 2011, as you all know, to coincide with the 10th anniversary of the September 11 attacks. On the 1st of June 2011, Noam Chomsky was named a 2011 winner of the Sydney Peace Prize. The New York Times has acknowledged him as arguably the most important intellectual alive. Professor Chomsky's only previous visit to Melbourne was in January 1995, where he presented a lecture entitled Democracy and Markets in the New World Order, also for Deakin University and also for the Faculty of Arts, in a very overcrowded World Trade Center, which was the largest building that could accommodate him in Melbourne at that time. Tonight's lecture continues his association with Deakin University, and the title of tonight's lecture effectively updates and extends the observations he made 16 years ago. On a personal note, in a week when Occupy Melbourne has focused the views of the many on the powers of the few, I look forward to this oration and what it is we will learn this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Professor Noam Chomsky for the oration.
Thank you. There are quite definitely changes in world order. They're undoubtedly of considerable significance. I think there are some questions about how they're interpreted. I'll talk about those. One prominent concern these days is what is called American decline. In the current issue of the leading political science journal in the United States, the Journal of the American Academy of Political Science, you can read, it's a common theme that the United States, which only a few years ago was held to stride the world as a colossus with unparalleled power and unmatched appeal, is in decline, ominously facing the prospects of its final decay. There's a common corollary to that, which holds that there has been a long-term shift of power from east to west, first to Northwest Europe, then across the Atlantic to the United States, and now moving across the Pacific to the rising powers, China and India. If that were true, it would mean we're going back to something like the 18th century, when they were, in fact, the commercial and industrial centers of the world before the imperial period. Well, American decline is very real. The corollary, however, I think is quite dubious. There certainly has been impressive economic growth in China and India, but they remain very poor countries with severe internal problems not known in the developed countries of the West. By no means faced in the rich countries. China, for all of its enormous growth, still remains largely an assembly plant for parts and components, high technology provided by the peripheral industrial powers, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, also the West, the Western countries, it presumably will ultimately move up the technology ladder, but that's a long, hard path, and the internal problems are significant, enormous, in fact, even more so in India. American decline is entirely real, but in the foreseeable future, I don't see any indication that there's any competitor for a hegemonic global power. The world is getting a lot more diverse, but that's a different matter. There are further qualifications in order. One is that American decline is not new, contrary to the common theme. In fact, it's been going on since the end of the Second World War. 1945 was the peak of American power. At that point, American global power was just colossal. The United States literally had 50% of the world's wealth. It had a position of its the other industrial powers had been severely damaged or destroyed during the Second World War, which was economically of enormous benefit to the United States. It ended the Depression. U.S. industrial production almost quadrupled during the Second World War, while its competitors were severely harmed. And long before the war, the U.S. already had been far and away the richest country in the world. Also, the United States had enormous, unparalleled security. It controlled the entire Western Hemisphere, both oceans, the opposite sides of both oceans. There had never been a system of power even closely approaching that in world history. However, the decline began right away. In 1949, there was a very serious blow to U.S. global power. It has a name. It's called the loss of China. China became independent. That phrase, a loss of China, is an interesting one. Also interesting that it's never questioned. But if you think about it, there's something very instructive about it. I can't lose your computer. I can only lose something that I possess. And the phrase loss of China presupposes that we possess China. That's supposed to be taken for granted and is taken for granted. It's a reflection of the deeply rooted imperial conception that the rich Western powers, the United States in the lead, own the world. And therefore, if anything moves on an independent path, they've lost it. And the concept loss of China, the events that it describes, have been a major issue in world affairs ever since. Well, the loss of China, so-called, was a very serious blow to plans that were laid during the Second World War. U.S. planners, President Roosevelt's planners, were well aware that during the war that the United States was going to emerge as a power of overwhelming dominance. And they laid careful, sophisticated plans for how the post-war world should be organized. In the early stages of the war, they assumed that Germany would emerge from the war as a major force in Eurasia. So there would be essentially two global systems, a German-run world in Europe and parts of Asia, and an American-run world. The American-run world was called the Grand Area, and its contours were sketched closely. The Grand Area was to include the entire Western Hemisphere, the entire Far East. That's why the loss of China was so serious. The former British Empire, including, crucially, Western Asia, the Middle East, with its enormous energy resources. That's the Grand Area, at a minimum. As the Russian armies began to grind the Germans down after Stalingrad, it was recognized that Germany would not survive the war, and the contours of the Grand Area were expanded to include the most significant parts of Europe, commercial and industrial centers of Europe, Western Europe, and Southern Europe, which was of great significance because of sea lanes for energy transfer from the Middle East, and in fact, as much of Eurasia as possible. So that's the Grand Area. Britain, meanwhile, would become what the British Foreign Office ruefully conceded was a junior partner to U.S. power previous, before the war. Britain, of course, had been the dominant global power. The energy resources of the Middle East, West Asia, were in fact recognized already to be staggering. The State Department in 1945 described them as a stupendous source of strategic power, one of the greatest material prizes in world history. Shortly after, President Eisenhower described the region as the strategically most important part of the world. One of Roosevelt's leading advisors, an important statesman, A. Burley, observed that if whoever controls the Middle East can gain substantial control of the world. Well, the United States did not intend to give that up, and it doesn't intend to now. That's a highly relevant to current affairs, today's headlines and tomorrow's events. Summarizing the very distinguished British diplomatic historian, Geoffrey Warner, one of the leading specialists on this topic, points out that the documentary record shows clearly that President Roosevelt was aiming at U.S. hegemony in the post-war world. That's quite correct, and it was a very plausible assumption given the objective circumstances. Well, within these vast domains, the grand area, there were specific plans, and they were carefully implemented. The plans implemented in the early post-war years follow very closely the planning documents of the 1939 to 1945 period called War Peace Studies Groups. High officials in the State Department and extra-governmental specialists from the Council on Foreign Relations. Incidentally, this documentary material has been open for right away. In fact, it was never classified. It's kind of strange that it hasn't been used much by diplomatic historians. It's very revealing about Second World War plans and the way they were later implemented. Within the grand area, the United States was to, I'm quoting now, the United States was to maintain unquestioned power with military and economic supremacy while ensuring the limitation of any exercise of sovereignty by states that might interfere with U.S. global designs. Now, that's quite an expansive vision. The doctrines, incidentally, still prevail, but the power to implement them has significantly declined. That's American decline. The planning, as I said, was sophisticated, and it continued to be as it began to be implemented in the early post-war years. One of the major figures was George Kennan, head of the State Department planning staff. Kennan, incidentally, was more or less on the dovish end of the spectrum. In fact, he was soon kicked out. He was considered not to be tough enough for this harsh world. Kennan and his staff assigned to every section of the world what they called its function within the overall grand area. So, for example, Southeast Asia had the function of providing resources and raw materials to the former colonial masters so that they could reconstruct and would be in a position to purchase the manufacturing surplus of the United States. The U.S. had a huge manufacturing system, had few markets. The only plausible market was Europe, and Southeast Asia had the function of helping them reconstruct. And so it went throughout the world. There was one part of the world that the U.S. had no particular interest in at the time, that was Africa. And Kennan therefore proposed that Africa should be handed over to Europe to exploit, that's his word, should be handed over to Europe to exploit for its reconstruction. Looking at the historical relations between Europe and Africa. You can imagine a different conception for the post-war world, an obvious one, but that, of course, was never considered. That's incidentally changed in more recent years. The United States is now unwilling to give up Europe to Africa to exploit. It wants to take part in it itself and is working hard to set up military and diplomatic structures to gain substantial control over Africa. That's part of the important changing contours of the world. Well, by 1949, as I said, the grand vision was beginning to crumble with the loss of China. It's quite serious. Shortly after came the threat of loss of Southeast Asia, first in Indochina. Indochina was seeking independence from French domination, which would undermine the function of Southeast Asia and the grand area. Actually, Indochina didn't matter that much in itself, but it was significant because of its relation to a much greater threat, the loss of Indonesia. Indonesia has extremely rich resources. You'll pardon me continuing to use the conventional phrase loss of one or another region. It's an obnoxious phrase, in my opinion, for the reasons I mentioned, but it's standard usage, so I'll keep to it. So the loss of Indonesia was very much considered quite serious if it happened. In 1948, George Kennan, head of the planning staff, warned that if Indonesia is lost, if it falls under what he called communism, a term that usually means independent nationalism, if Indonesia falls under communism, it could be an infection that would sweep westward through all of South Asia, even threatening U.S. dominance in the Middle East. And he therefore concluded that the problem of Indonesia is the most crucial issue of the moment in our struggle with the Kremlin. The Kremlin would have been pretty hard to find in Indonesia, but that's a metaphor for independence. That's 1948. And all of that enters into planning for the Vietnam War in ways that are worth understanding. The Vietnam War, the Indochina Wars in general, are maybe the most important, certainly one of the most important events of the last half of the 20th century. They went on, of course, until 1975 with residues that continue. The concern over, if you look at, it's commonly said that the U.S. suffered a defeat in Indochina. And that's not entirely false, but it's not entirely accurate either. It would be more accurate to say that the United States had a partial victory. It achieved its major war aims, but not its maximal war aims. And if you have a really expansive conception of the need for dominance, a failure to achieve your maximal aims is considered a kind of a horrendous failure. The reasoning behind the concern over Indochina and the long destructive war was pretty straightforward. It's analyzed clearly in the internal documents, and furthermore, it's a theme that you find throughout modern history, a very important theme. Indochina was what was, to use Henry Kissinger's later terms, it was what was called, what's been called a virus that might spread contagion elsewhere. The virus was independent nationalism. Successful independent nationalism, turns out to work out, may inspire others to try to pursue the same course. So you have a virus spreading contagion, and it was the concern was the contagion might reach Indonesia, which is significant, and then on to what Asia historian John Dower called the super domino, Japan. If Southeast Asia was infected by the virus, caught the contagion spread and moved towards independence, Japan might, as planners put it, might accommodate itself to an independent East Asia becoming its a technological industrial center, and using the surrounding region as a market and resource base. Now, that would in effect be providing Japan with what it sought to attain by military conquest during the Second World War. Look back at the Second World War, Japan was trying to construct what it called a new order in Asia, which would have exactly that character. And the United States was not prepared to lose the Pacific phase of World War II in the immediate post-war years. And therefore, thinking through this reasoning, the loss of Indochina, namely its move towards independent development, might be quite serious. Well, how do you deal with a virus that's going to spread contagion? What you do is try to destroy the virus and try to protect the potential targets of the infection from the contagion. And that's exactly what was done in that region and, in fact, elsewhere too, commonly. Again, major theme of post-war history. So the virus was destroyed. Vietnam was devastated. In fact, all of Indochina was destroyed. It would never be a model of independent development that others would follow. And the region was inoculated by installing murderous and brutal dictators who would be could be counted on to block any move towards independence. That happened in country after country throughout the region, all either instigated or supported by the United States and Britain, sometimes France when they could. The most important case, again, was Indonesia. In 1965, there was a military coup in Indonesia, General Suharto's coup. It was supported, clearly, openly supported by the United States, perhaps instigated by it, and it was very successful. It ended the threat of that Indonesia might catch the virus, might move towards a successful independent development. The coup killed hundreds of thousands of people, mostly landless peasants. It destroyed the a major mass-based political party, ended the threat of democracy in Indonesia. This is a party that the Australian specialist Harold Crouch, leading specialist on Indonesia, calls it a party that had won widespread support, not as a revolutionary party, but as an organization defending the interests of the poor within the existing system. Well, that was devastated along with its mass base after huge massacres. And the coup opened up Indonesia to free exploitation of its enormous resources by the West. So it was extremely successful. And it elicited unconstrained euphoria in the United States and Australia, Britain, the West generally. And the descriptions were pretty accurate. So the New York Times, for example, described what was happening as a staggering mass slaughter, which its leading liberal commentator, James Reston, called a gleam of light in Asia. Time magazine devoted most of its issue to what they called a boiling bloodbath. There were headlines like hope where there once was none, so on and so forth. The euphoria was literally unconstrained and understandable in the context of the internal acceptance, unquestioned acceptance of a conception of global order of the kind that I outlined, and it is in the internal records. One of the more interesting commentaries on this was by McGeorge Bundy. He was the National Security Advisor for Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, and one of the main architects of the Vietnam War in those years. In later years, he commented that it might have been a wise idea for the United States to pull out of Vietnam in 1965, because the war had been essentially won. Vietnam by that time was already virtually destroyed, and Indonesia was protected from contagion by the highly successful Suharto coup, so going on beyond that was kind of pointless, his picture in retrospect. Well, similar things were happening in Latin America. It had been taken for granted in grand area planning that Latin America would simply be in the pocket of the United States. Our little region over here, which has never bothered anyone, as Secretary of War Stimson called it. But that wasn't so simple. There was a problem very soon in Guatemala. Guatemala overthrew a dictatorship and instituted steps towards democratization, land reform, and so on. That was considered quite threatening. The Eisenhower government carried out a military coup, which overthrew the democratic system and installed a murderous and violent terror state, which to this day is carrying out horrifying atrocities. Not so bad as before. The peak was actually in the Reagan years and the 1980s. In fact, a lot of the immigrants desperately seeking to enter the United States, even today, literally today, are Mayan refugees from the highlands in Guatemala, where virtual genocide was carried out in the 1980s. The fear, the concern about Guatemala was the same about as Indochina. Concern was it might be a virus that might infect others. That virus was quickly stamped out. And it continues that way pretty much throughout Latin America. There was one clear exception, and that was Cuba. In 1959, Cuba liberated itself for the first time, the Castro victory, and the United States reacted very harshly, quite quickly, within a few months, bombing of Cuba began from Florida bases. A formal decision was taken secretly to overthrow the government. When John F. Kennedy came in 1961, that escalated the attacks on Cuba, led to the there were reasons for it, and in fact, here again, the internal records are quite revealing. Kennedy had a special interest in Latin America, and he established a Latin American mission to analyze how the United States should deal with Latin America. It was headed by Arthur Schlesinger, a famous liberal historian, Kennedy advisor, one of his main advisors on Latin America in particular. This is before Kennedy came into office. It's a report intended for the incoming president. And Schlesinger summarized the report. He pointed out to President Kennedy that the problem is, I'm now quoting it, the problem in Cuba is the Castro idea of taking matters into your own hands, an idea which might influence others in the region who face similar problems and might try to do the same thing. So it's a virus that might spread contagion. And usual cure was tried. First try to kill the virus. I'll come back in a moment to how that was done, although you know the basic story. Kill the virus and inoculate the region. Right away, the U.S. began to support military coups throughout the region. The first and most important was in Brazil, the most important country of the region. There was a military coup planned under the Kennedy administration, carried out a few weeks after Kennedy's assassination. And it installed the first of a series of what were called national security states, basically kind of neo-Nazi terror and torture states, which were very brutal and violent. They then spread throughout the region. One of them was what in Latin America is called the first 9/11, 9/11, 1973. That's the overthrow of the parliamentary government of Chile on September 11th, 1973, the installation of the Pinochet dictatorship. Actually, if you think about it, the first 9/11 was incomparably worse than the second 9/11, the one we call 9/11. Just imagine, do a thought experiment, consider what we call 9/11. which was bad enough. It was a horrific atrocity. But suppose it could have been worse. Suppose, for example, that the plane that was downed in Pennsylvania by the passengers, suppose it had gone on and hit its target, which was probably the White House. Suppose it had hit the White House, killed the president, didn't have to be there, but suppose he was, killed the president, set off plans which were in process for a military dictatorship, established a military dictatorship in the United States, which immediately killed thousands of people, tortured tens of thousands, established a major terror center in the United States, which initiated and supported comparable military coups elsewhere in the hemisphere and beyond, carried out assassinations far and wide, brought in a group of economists who quickly drove the United States into the worst depression in its history. Suppose all of that had happened. Well, that would have been a lot worse than 9/11. Since we did it to them, it's out of history. And nobody talks about the first 9/11 except in Latin America. If you think it through, I think you see that this was this kind of comparison is quite apt. Henry Kissinger, who was one of the architects of the coup, assured President Nixon that his boss, that what happened was of no historic significance. In contrast, the second 9/11 is commonly claimed to have changed the world. Well, that's the difference between us and them, the rich and the powerful versus the weak and the victims, worth thinking about. Well, that's this plague of repression that spread through Latin America included Brazil, Chile, Uruguay. The worst of the criminal states that was installed was Argentina. That was Ronald Reagan's darling. He loved Argentina, supported the dictatorship, which was the most brutal and vicious of all of them. Then the plague spread to Central America in the 1980s with hundreds of thousands of people killed, any threat of independent development crushed. So the region was inoculated, but the U.S. couldn't quite exterminate the virus, though it was contained. Kennedy invaded, the Bay of Pigs invasion, that was beaten back. Immediately after the invasion was beaten back, Kennedy instituted a major war of terror against Cuba. Arthur Schlesinger, liberal historian who was made Latin American advisor, described the policy as one of bringing the terrors of the earth to Cuba. That's Schlesinger's description in his biography of Robert Kennedy, the president's brother. He points out Robert Kennedy was given responsibility for bringing the terrors of the earth to Cuba. That was his prime responsibility, and he was dedicated to it. And the war was a very serious one. We have plenty of documents from it. Thousands of people were killed. There was sabotage, destruction, sinking of ships, shelling, destruction of industrial installations, probable biological warfare. It was no joke, and it continued for a long time. Also, the United States instituted an embargo to try to strangle the country. It still continues. The CIA explained itself what the problem was. It said the problem in Cuba is Cuba's successful defiance of U.S. policies going back to the Monroe Doctrine. That was 1823. The Monroe Doctrine proclaimed the U.S. right to essentially dominate the hemisphere. Couldn't do it at that time. It wasn't strong enough. There was a deterrent, Britain, which was much stronger. The British were a deterrent, but the U.S. planners back as far as the 1820s recognized that over time, Britain's power would decline, U.S. power would increase, and ultimately Cuba would fall into our hands like an apple from a tree by the laws of political gravitation. I'm quoting John Quincy Adams, great grand strategist, is the intellectual author of the Monroe Doctrine and Manifest Destiny, and that indeed happened. Through the 19th century, U.S. became more powerful, British power declined. In 1898, the U.S. essentially invaded Cuba. It's called the liberation of Cuba, but in fact it was the prevention of Cuba's liberation from Spain. Cuba had pretty much liberated itself from Spain. The U.S. invasion put an end to that and turned Cuba into a virtual colony, as it remained until 1959. And then came this danger, what the CIA called the successful defiance of policies going back 150 years. It had nothing to do with the Russians, of course, but though they're always the pretext in those years. And Schlesinger's analysis that it was a virus that would spread contagion was the typical one, same one that's used in Indochina and many other places. If you want to understand the history of this period, you have to recognize that these quite rational themes occur over and over. Sometimes they're called the domino theory, but that doesn't capture the significance and the meaning of what in fact happened over and over. The case of Cuba gives actually considerable insight into how policy is formed. It's worth studying for that reason, too. For about 40 years, public opinion in the United States has been strongly opposed to the policies against Cuba. The large majority of the public wants to normalize relations with Cuba. Well, it's normal for public opinion to be dismissed in what we call democracies. But what's more interesting in this case is that major sectors of American business have also been in favor of normalization. Now, quite typically, they're the sectors that determine policy. But in this case, they've been overruled, which is why it's interesting. And that's major business interests, agribusiness, pharmaceuticals, energy corporations. Now, these are not small parts of the American corporate sector. They're central parts. But they're dismissed. There's a state dedication to punishing successful defiance, and it overwhelms the usual modalities of policy formation, which are usually pretty much in the hands of private capital. It's not the only such case. There are other such cases, and they're worth looking at closely if you want to understand policy formation. Actually, Iran is another case like that. Well, going back to post-war planning, the main concern, of course, was Europe. Europe had to be reconstituted, had to be reconstructed, but there was, however, a preliminary condition. The first thing that was necessary was to destroy the anti-fascist resistance, and which was basically kind of radical democratic, called the left. That was the first target of U.S. and British forces as they landed in the continent. You recall that first they landed in Italy and in Greece and the southern part of the continent. And their first goal was to dismantle Greece and Italy in particular had extremely powerful partisan movements, resistance movements. In each country they were holding down six German divisions. In Italy, most of Italy had been liberated by the resistance before the British and the Americans got there. And they had to be, the society that they developed had to be thrown out. The U.S. and Britain destroyed it, brought back fascist collaborators, and essentially reconstructed the old order, blocking, destroying the resistance, and instituting the kind of system that they preferred. In Greece, it was very bloody. There was a civil war in which maybe 150,000 people or so were killed, went on for years, and restored the pre-war quasi-fascist government. There was an actual literal fascist coup later that the U.S. supported. Greece and Italy were of particular significance, as I mentioned before, because in global planning, they were part of the protecting the sea lanes from which energy was provided from the huge material prize in West Asia, the Middle East, through Europe and beyond. In fact, Greece was actually in the Near East section of the State Department until 1974, the overthrow of the dictatorship. It was considered part of the Middle East, not part of Europe. It's worth thinking about today when you notice what's going on. Well, this in Italy, Italy was the main target of US subversion, at least until the 1970s, when the internal record runs dry. Massive subversion attempts to prevent Italian democracy from functioning, to prevent the rise of the left. Germany was, of course, particularly important. It was necessary in Germany to dismantle union constitutions, to terminate social experiments, and in general, I'm quoting, to wall off Western Germany from the Eastern Zone to prevent infection of radical democratic ideas, social change. That phrase, incidentally, is George Kennan's again, an interesting phrase, got to wall off Western Germany from the contagion in the East. Well, it was always recognized that Europe might follow an independent path, perhaps a kind of a Gaullist path, something like de Gaulle's conception of Europe from the Atlantic to the Urals, an independent force in world affairs, third force it was called. And that had to be stopped. And there were various measures taken to prevent it. One is called NATO. It's actually quite interesting to see what happened to NATO when the pretext for it, you know, the Russian hordes, disappeared. I'll get back to that in a moment. But that's part of its function, and continues to be, was to ensure that Europe would not become pull out of the grand area as an independent force. Remains a major issue. Well, meanwhile, throughout this whole period, decolonization was following its agonizing course. And throughout this period, the decline continued. By 1970, the United States had about 25% of global wealth, still has approximately that. That's very substantial, but it's not 50%. That's a sharp decline. The world by 1970 was becoming economically tripolar, as it's called. There's a North American economic center based in the United States, a European, comparable European economic center, German-based, and an East Asian center, at that point Japan-based, later Japan-China-based, which is already the most dynamic economic area in the world. Well, that's 1970. 20 years later, 1990, Soviet Union collapsed. And for those who are interested in the reality of the Cold War and in what shapes foreign policy generally, it's highly instructive to look at how the United States reacted when the superpower enemy collapsed. So what happened? It's kind of striking that scholarship pays almost no attention to that, but it's clearly of very great importance, and if you look closely, quite instructive. So, of course, new policies were instituted. This was President Bush, first President Bush. There was a new, incidentally, it's all public. You don't have to search hidden records. It's always been public. There was a new national security strategy and a new defense budget. And looking at them tells you quite a lot. One aspect was that it would be necessary, they said it would be necessary to maintain a huge military system and not to protect the West from the Russians. They're not around any longer. But to protect the West from what was called the technological sophistication of third world powers. Now, if you're a well-educated intellectual, you don't laugh when you hear that. You take it seriously. We need a huge military system to protect ourselves from the technological sophistication of third world powers. That's a sign of proper education to take that seriously. You're not supposed to laugh. What it meant, of course, was that the the huge military system never was intended to defend the West from the Russian hordes, but rather to maintain grand area control, and that was still necessary. A second element of the new system was that it was necessary to protect what they called the defense industrial base. What's the defense industrial base? That's a euphemism for the high-tech economy. Free markets are fine for the weak, but not for us. We, the powerful, need a powerful state that sustains the economy, saves the wealthy when they're in trouble, and so on. The modern high-tech economy very largely derives from what's called the defense industrial base, Pentagon-funded research and development. That includes computers, the internet, in fact, the entire, virtually the entire information technology revolution, microelectronics, satellites, on and on. After about 30 years in the state sector, largely, these were handed over to private power for profit. And this system had to be maintained. That's what it means to maintain the defense industrial base. Actually, there's nothing really new about that. That goes back to the earliest days of modern industrialization in Britain and the United States, other developing powers, Japan, and East Asian tigers, and so on. In fact, every developed society has had something of this character. The third element of the planning in the immediate period of the collapse of the Soviet Union, the third element had to do with military intervention. The new defense strategy and military budget insisted that military intervention forces aimed at the Middle East must be maintained. And then came an interesting phrase. These intervention forces must be maintained, directed toward the Middle East, where the serious problems we faced could not have been laid at the Kremlin's door, contrary to 50 years of deception. So it wasn't because of the Russians and the Russian threat that we were directing military intervention forces towards the Middle East. Sorry, folks, we've been lying to you for 50 years, but now we have to tell you the truth. The Russians aren't there. We can't blame them. And the problem is indeed what it always was and is in other parts of the world, too. What's called radical nationalism, independent nationalism, which might tear apart the system of imperial control. Well, quietly conceded at that point, but that didn't matter much because none of this is ever reported. In fact, you can barely find it even in academic scholarship, but it's there. It's very, very open and perfectly public documents. You can find it if you like. Well, in the Middle East, as elsewhere, there had been viruses which threatened contagion. They had to be dealt with in the usual way. One was Iran in 1953, where Britain and the United States intervened to overthrow the parliamentary democracy, install the tyranny of the Shah. There was another military coup in Iraq in 1963, initiated by the CIA. The most important case was 1967, the Israeli destruction of Nasser. He was the virus, a secular leader of secular nationalism. The 67 wars conventionally described, and not inaccurately, as a war between Israel and mainly Egypt, which is true, but there was another war going on, highly relevant. Now, that was a war between Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Now, Saudi Arabia and Egypt were at war in the mid-1960s. This was a conflict between a radical Islamic fundamentalism centered in Saudi Arabia and secular nationalism centered in Nasser's Egypt. The United States and Britain have fairly consistently over the years supported radical Islamic fundamentalism as a barrier to the much greater danger of secular nationalism. And 67 is an important case in point. In 1967, Israel performed an enormous service to the United States and Saudi Arabia, its major ally in the region, because that's where most of the oil is. It destroyed the major threat to their radical Islamism and the barrier to secular nationalist efforts that might have tried to convert the resources of the region to domestic needs. That's the danger. And 1967, this service that Israel performed, that established U.S.-Israeli relations in their present form, kind of unique form. Before that, the relations were nothing special. Right after that came what's called the Nixon Doctrine, Richard Nixon. It presented the structure of control of the Middle East. Primarily, we support the radical fundamentalist Islamic dictatorships like Saudi Arabia. That's where the oil is, so they're our main allies. But they have to be protected, mainly from their own populations, and they have to be protected by what the Nixon Doctrine called the cops on the beat, local gendarmes who would protect the ruling dictatorships from their populations. And there's an array of these, preferably non-Arab. They'd do a better job of killing Arabs. Shah of Iran. Iran was one of the main ones, was then under the Shah. Turkey, Pakistan, which provided a lot of the military force for the Saudi dictatorship. Turkey, if I mentioned that, and now Israel was added to it. Those are the cops on the beat. Police headquarters, of course, stays in Washington, and there's a kind of a branch office in London in case we need our junior partner to do something. Well, that's that was the Nixon Doctrine. In that framework, Israel had a fundamental role. When the Shah was overthrown in 1975, that role actually increased, and pretty much that framework remains in one form or another. It still is the core of the U.S.-Israeli relationship, despite many changes since. Well, let's go back to the end of the Cold War, 1990. The fate of NATO is quite instructive. The Russian hordes were gone, so you no longer needed NATO to protect Europe from the Russian hordes. Well, if anybody had believed the propaganda of the preceding years, they would have expected that NATO would dissolve. That's the reason for its existence is gone. That's not what happened. Instead, NATO expanded to the east in violation of explicit pledges to Gorbachev, Prime Minister Gorbachev, who was willing to permit German unification within a hostile military alliance on condition that NATO would not expand one inch to the east. That was the phrase that the Bush administration promised to Gorbachev. Actually, Gorbachev's concession was quite significant in the light of history. After all, Germany alone had practically destroyed Russia several times during the century, and now Gorbachev was willing to allow a unified, militarized Germany to be part of a hostile military alliance in return for the concession that NATO would not expand one inch to the east. Well, NATO immediately expanded, instantly expanded to East Germany in violation of the promise and then beyond. Gorbachev was pretty annoyed, as you can imagine. But when he complained, Washington explained to him that he was naive enough to accept verbal promises from the United States. That's his problem. And NATO now continues to expand. By now, its official mission, apart from serving as a U.S.-run global intervention force, its official mission is to protect what's called the infrastructure of the global energy system. That means sea lanes, pipelines, most of the world. Well, I mentioned before that there was quoting the Journal of the American Academy of Political Science, I mentioned that there was great euphoria in the 1990s about the magnificence of the U.S. Great Colossus. In fact, that's a kind of a strange period of intellectual history and worth looking at closely. The rhetoric was pretty astonishing. So Clinton, I'm quoting now from liberal intellectuals, historians, and so on, they praised, Clinton's foreign policy was praised as having entered a noble phase with a saintly glow, as for the first time in history, a country is guided by altruism alone, dedicated to principles and values, an idealistic new world bent on ending inhumanity. At last it could carry forward, it's unhindered, it's the emerging international norm of humanitarian intervention leading to a magnificent world. This went on and on through the 1990s. Well, of course, not everybody was so enraptured. The Global South, for example, the traditional victims, they saw it quite differently. They bitterly condemned the so-called right of humanitarian intervention, which they saw as just the old right of imperialist domination, continues up till today. After Bush Jr. took over, hostility to the United States and the Global South, and particularly the Middle East, grew enormously. Obama, in fact, has carried out a major feat. He succeeded in lowering his popularity in the Arab world, even below Bush. That's not a small achievement. Obama's approval rating in Egypt, the most important country, is about 5%, meaning essentially nobody, and there are similar numbers elsewhere. Well, meanwhile, the decline continued. In the last decade, first decade of this millennium, something extremely significant happened. South America has been lost in the conventional term. The threat had been around for a long time. I mentioned a number of examples. There were plenty of brutal interventions, but it finally happened. For the first time in half a millennium since the European explorers arrived, South America has begun to move towards integration, prerequisite for independence. It's begun to face quite severe internal problems. One sign of its independence is that U.S. military bases have been entirely thrown out of South America. That's pretty significant. A new organization is just forming, CELAC it's called, which includes all countries of the Western Hemisphere except for the United States and Canada. That's, if it actually functions, that'll be quite significant, another great loss to grand area planning. And that's pretty serious. When the Nixon administration was planning to destroy another virus, namely in Chile, the National Security Council advised that if the United States cannot control Latin America, it will not be able to achieve a successful order elsewhere in the world, that is, to run the rest of the world. So it's essential to maintain control over Latin America. Now, that's been substantially lost. Well, that's bad enough, but the Middle East is far more important, and that's beginning to happen. I've already quoted government assessments of the significance of the Middle East oil back in the 1940s. Again, planners recognized that if we can control the Middle East, we can control the world, and as a corollary, if we lose control of the Middle East, control of the world declines. Well, the policies remain pretty much the same. But notice that it's not a matter of access, it's a matter of control. In fact, during the period when the U.S. was the major oil exporter, it wasn't taking a drop of oil from the Middle East, it maintained the same policies. But control is being threatened. There's a further danger to U.S. hegemony, the possibility that the Middle East, or what's called MENA, Middle East, North Africa, MENA may move towards some form of democracy. That would be really frightening. There's lots of rhetoric about the yearning for democracy and so on, but there are very good reasons why the United States and its allies will do whatever they can to prevent functioning democracy, authentic democracy in the Middle East. A very simple reason. Just take a look at polls. In a functioning democracy, public opinion influences policy. So what's public opinion? Well, you know, a lot's known about it. The Arab world is carefully polled by leading U.S. polling agencies, polls released by prestigious institutions. It's easy to find them. They're not reported, but their planners certainly know about them. And what they say is very significant. So take, say, again, Egypt, the most important country. Back about a year ago, right before the Arab Spring broke out, polls in Egypt showed that about 90% of Egyptians regarded the U.S. and Israel as the main threats to Egypt. About 10% regarded Iran as a threat. In fact, opposition to U.S. policy was so strong that about 80% of Egyptians thought that the region would be more secure if Iran had nuclear weapons. On separate questions, they do not want Iran to have nuclear weapons, not surprisingly, but they think the region would be more secure if Iran had them to balance the real threat, U.S. and Israel. Figures throughout the region are vary a little bit, but they're more or less similar. Well, you know, the last thing that the U.S. and Britain and France, the three traditional imperial powers, the last thing they want is for public opinion to have an influence on policy. That's pretty obvious, and that's what democracy means, so it follows. You can anticipate they'll do whatever they can to stifle democracy. Well, of course, talking about yearning for democracy and so on. Even after, there have been some victories in Egypt, partial victories, but the traditional military regime is still intact, and there's plenty of ongoing conflict about that. One shouldn't underestimate the victories, incidentally. The press in Egypt is quite free, it wasn't before. The labor movement, which has been at the core of the protests, has been a very militant labor movement in Egypt and Tunisia, the two countries where there have been some successes for many years, and they're now much more free than they were before. That's significant. But the basic regime is still in place. And even with the partial democratization, partial move of the public towards some influence, Egypt has taken moves which are very threatening to U.S. power and Israel. For one thing, Egypt, for the first time in 30 years, has permitted Iranian ships, including military vessels, to transit the Suez Canal into the Mediterranean, which is supposed to be an American lake. They're moving towards diplomatic relations with Iran. Egypt has led a unification effort to unify the two Palestinian factions, Hamas and Fatah. Now, that's quite threatening to the U.S. and Israel, and if you notice, they reacted in a very hostile way. The reason is that for 20 years, since the early 1990s, U.S.-Israeli policy has been devoted to separating Gaza from the West Bank. That happens to be an explicit violation of the Oslo Accords, which describe the West Bank and Gaza as a territorial unity. But that's been U.S.-Israeli policy consistently since the Oslo Accords were established. And the reasoning is fairly straightforward. If there's any kind of independence for some fragments of the West Bank, if they're separated from Gaza, they'll be totally imprisoned, have no outlet to the outside world. They'll be imprisoned between Israel and the Jordanian dictatorship, including whatever parts of the West Bank Israel takes over. Well, there's a more serious problem still on the agenda. And that's the 1979 Israel-Egypt peace treaty. Public opinion in Egypt, it doesn't want to get rid of the treaty. They don't want a war, but they don't like the way in which the dictatorship has interpreted the treaty. Right away, since 1979, the treaty was interpreted by the Egyptian dictatorship, and of course by the US and Israel, as eliminating the Egyptian deterrent and therefore giving Israel license to do anything it wanted, to attack its northern neighbor, Lebanon, as it did almost immediately, to escalate its operations in the West Bank. Well, the Egyptian public doesn't like that, didn't like it, still doesn't. If they have any influence, that is, if democracy actually progresses, then they might threaten that interpretation of the treaty. And it's kind of interesting to see the way that's described in the West, say the New York Times. They say that would threaten the cornerstone of stability in the Middle East. Stability here is used in its technical meaning. Do what we say, that's stability. In the literal meaning, the treaty is the cornerstone of instability in the Middle East, like invading Lebanon and taking over the West Bank, but not from the Western point of view. Well, there's a lot more to say about all of this, but I want to make a final comment about another crucial fact. While American decline is quite real and has been going on since 1945, in large measure it's self-inflicted, and that's important to understand. There was a major change in world order in the 1970s. Just take the United States. Throughout its history, with some ups and downs, and not in very attractive ways, the United States had been a growing, advancing power. Started as a poor agricultural country, by the end of the 19th century, already the most powerful country in the world, and on through the Second World War, and then in the several decades beyond 50s and 60s, period of maximal growth. But throughout this entire period, the U.S. was a growing, advancing industrial power. And that was, there's a psychological aspect to that. There was always, even in the darkest days, there was a sense of hopefulness. We'll go on, our children will be better off than we will, and so on and so forth. Well, that goes on up to the 1970s. At that point, there was a turn. From that point on, the United States has been a deindustrializing power. And the sense of hopefulness has declined very severely, of course, for objective reasons. Two major things happened in the 70s. In the United States, other industrial countries too, but let's talk about that. One change was a shift of the economy from production of useful things to finance. Games with money, you know, speculation, manipulation of financial shenanigans and so on. That grew enormously since the 1970s. Production, meanwhile, continued, but overseas. Production was exported, offshore. There's a kind of a common core to those two moves. They both had to do with the fact that the rate of profit in manufacturing was declining, so you could make more profit by financial shenanigans and offshore production. But it took place. The financial sector of the economy doesn't help the economy, probably harms it, but it's become huge. By 2007, right before the last crash, it was about 40% of corporate profits. That's not small. These things have effects. One effect is a high concentration of income in the hands primarily of financial sectors. The top 0.1% of the income spectrum, so sector so small that the census can't even pick it up. Now, that's the core reason for the tremendous inequality that's developed. And concentration of capital, of course, leads to concentration of political power, which in turn leads to legislation that keeps the vicious cycle moving. Meanwhile, for the mass of the population, large majority, in wealth, income have pretty much stagnated, sometimes declined. Well, what the West has been doing, US, Britain, and others, is living out a kind of a nightmare that was actually described by the classical economists, Adam Smith and David Ricardo, the founders of modern economics. Their concern, of course, was England. Adam Smith, in Wealth of Nations, wrote that if the masters of the British society, the merchants and manufacturers, if they decided to do their business abroad, to produce abroad and to import from abroad, then they would profit, but England would suffer. However, he said, this is probably not going to happen. The reason it won't happen is because British manufacturers and merchants would have what's called a home bias. They'd prefer to do their business in England. And therefore, as if by an invisible hand, England would be saved from the ravages of what we nowadays call a neoliberal globalized market. Now, that's a pretty hard passage to miss. That's the one use of the famous phrase, invisible hand, in Wealth of Nations, in what amounts to a critique of neoliberal globalization. The other great founder of classical economics, David Ricardo, said pretty much the same thing. He hoped that this wouldn't happen, basically for sentimental reasons. Well, the classical economists knew what they're talking about. For a long time, what they described was more or less accurate, and we're now living in the middle of the nightmare that they predicted. The effect, as I said, is a very narrow concentration of wealth, increasing concentration of political power, further measures to concentrate wealth and power, fiscal measures, rules of corporate governance, deregulation. It's catastrophic for the economy, very harmful for most of the population, and it's having a quite considerable effect on the nature of the society. It's enriching and empowering a tiny sector, but it's contributing to the decline of the United States as a functioning society. That's that's an important aspect of American decline. It's also succeeding in shredding the remnants of political democracy. Hence laying the basis for carrying the lethal process forward, and it will do so, will continue to do so, as long as the victims are willing to suffer in silence. Thanks.